This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, with the email and online marketing tools small businesses and nonprofits need to promote their organizations. Learn more at constantcontact.com.
You and your happy retirement on the program today. Longshoremen and the global economy as well. And juvenile justice and modern technology. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Fox Searchlight Pictures, the second best exotic Marigold Hotel, the new comedy starring Maggie Smith and Judi Dench, in theaters everywhere March 6th. And by Condor Airlines, introducing new service from Portland, Oregon and Providence, Rhode Island. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. And by Robert W. Baird & Company, providing global financial resources to advise clients the world over. BairdWealth.com has more information.
In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Monday, the 23rd of February. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. You know, sometimes the news of the day is somewhat simpler than those making the news would like you to believe it is. The White House, as you've heard, is pushing new rules for retirement advisors today. They're trying to improve the quality of the retirement advice that people get because some financial advisors, keyword here, some, not all, push their clients into investments that pay the advisor well, but sometimes aren't so good for said clients. The White House Council of Economic Advisors says that shady advice shaves 1% off average annual returns for those clients. And you may well be thinking right now, oh, come on, one lousy percent? What's all the hubbub, bub? Well, this is where we get to what the news is really about. It's about the miracle of compound interest. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson gets us going.
Pop quiz. Would you rather get $10,000 a day for 30 days or a penny that doubled in value every day for the same 30 days? Andrew Meadows is with Ubiquity Retirement and Savings. They provide retirement accounts for small businesses.
Well, I mean, I would definitely lean toward $10,000 a day for 30 days.
Right? On day two, you'd have $20,000 versus 2 cents. Feels like a no-brainer. But actually, the doubling penny is a better deal. You'd have more than $5 million by the end of the month, thanks to compounding. Crazy, right?
It's plain math. You know, I think a lot of our brains don't really work that way. Our minds sometimes aren't really structured in a way for us to really think about what something is going to look at 30 days from now or 30 years from now.
And time is a magic ingredient when it comes to compounding. Stephen Brobeck is the executive director at the Consumer Federation of America.
Some economists say that interest compounding is the only miracle in economics. It's essentially interest earning interest.
What you earn goes back into your account, and now you earn interest on that plus your initial investment. The longer you leave it, the more it snowballs. But that snowballing can work against you if you're in debt and paying interest instead of earning it. Diane Lim is an economist at the Committee for Economic Development.
You're never able to kind of start over with the original size snowball. It keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger and makes it more and more difficult for people to pay down debt.
So the trick is to get compounding working in the right direction. For savings, it's magic. On debt, it's misery. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
If you've got more questions on compound interest, and come on, you know you do, Marketplace's Patty Hirsch has a whiteboard video that explains it all. It is at marketplace.org. All right, moving on. It's still probably a couple of days before the cable news channels start running their government shutdown countdown clocks, but we are getting there. Funding for the Department of Homeland Security runs out on Friday. That is, unless the House and Senate can figure out some compromise. But even once lawmakers do figure something out, DHS has a whole nother problem with no quick fix. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has that story.
Every year, the federal government surveys its workers, asking, are you recognized for good work? Do you respect your leaders? And every year,
DHS does not stack up well.
That's Max Steyer. He's president of the Partnership for Public Service, a good government group that ranks morale at government agencies. For the past few years, DHS has come in dead last.
It is redefining the bottom of the rankings for large agencies.
Steyer says part of the problem is the way DHS was created after 9/11. 22 very different federal departments and agencies were mushed into one gigantic bureaucracy, but they all kept their congressional overseers. Now more than 80 committees and subcommittees have jurisdiction over DHS. Jeff Neal headed the agency's HR department from 2009 to 2011. He says he was constantly writing reports for Congress.
It didn't really help us run the department. It was very frustrating. We had other things that were more critical than writing reports.
Now Congress is causing DHS employees more headaches. Nicole Byram is president of the National Treasury Employees Union chapter in Savannah, Georgia. She's a Customs and Border Protection officer. Byram says this latest budget skirmish just makes morale worse.
People are very stressed out. People are very anxious. Everyone kind of has this feeling of, oh no, not again.
Because they know if Congress can't agree on how to keep funding DHS, there'll be a partial government shutdown. But they're considered essential, so they'll have to work without pay during the impasse. And getting back pay, that takes an act of Congress, a mood crusher sure to keep DHS at the bottom of the morale rankings. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, traders were trying real hard but still wound up just about where they started. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It's going to take a good long while for the backlogs to clear, but West Coast ports are slowly getting back to normal. Dock workers and shippers, as you know, reached a deal on a new 5-year contract Friday afternoon. That ends months of a standoff that has been felt literally around the world, from car assembly lines without crucial parts to billions of dollars worth of produce lost to a shortage of French fries in Japan. The influence, though, of organized labor has been in decline for years. So how do you suppose it came to pass that one relatively small union still has the power to cripple the American economy? From KPCC here in Los Angeles, Ben Bergman reports.
Neither side will disclose details of the new contract, but you can bet it's generous. Shipping companies say dock workers average $147,000 a year. The International Longshore and Warehouse Union, the ILWU, says if you take out a few specialized positions, the figure is closer to $80,000. Either way, a good salary, especially for non-college grads.
The ILWU is the American dream.
Dave Arian is vice president of the Port of L.A.'s Harbor Commission. Before that, he worked for 44 years on the docks and was an ILWU president.
My dad was a longshoreman. My daughter works on the waterfront. My sister retired off the waterfront. But there are some families that have 5 generations and 30 people down here or more.
Arian is well aware that dock workers are an anomaly, a throwback to the days when blue-collar workers could routinely join a union and live a comfortable middle-class life, complete with a generous pension and full benefits, such as the advantage of holding the power to shut down all 29 West Coast ports in your hands. That's opposed to the East and Gulf Coast, where ports aren't covered by a single contract.
I don't believe the longshoremen are any more militant than auto workers were, than mine workers were. But we have something they did have, a strategic position where we could choke off capital.
Because 40% of the goods imported into the U.S. come through the ports of L.A. and Long Beach. Being a dock worker is great work if you can get it, but the key is getting it.
The last time we put out applications, 360,000 people put in applications.
You heard that right, 360,000, and that was 10 years ago. the union resorted to a lottery to pick 16,000 so-called casuals, known as the grunts of the waterfront. They only pick up the work full cardholders don't want, and it's very sporadic, sometimes just one day a week. Graduating to a full Class B member can take a decade. But there are lucky ones like Carol Randolph, who was only a casual for a year and a half.
I'm kind of embarrassed to say. My son has a casual card right now. He's been there 7 years.
She actually has three kids working as casuals. She raised all three as a single parent and sent them to college on her union salary. But she has mixed feelings about her kids working the docks.
It is an extremely dangerous job. We don't have small accidents. We have accidents that kill.
We met for coffee at the end of her 9-hour shift at a diner where, like every other business near the ports of L.A. and Long Beach, there are union signs taped to the window. Randolph worked the docks for years but has enough seniority now that she can have one of the most desirable jobs, a vessel planner.
We pretty well decide in what order the containers will be coming off of the ship.
When I asked Randolph if the union wanted better health care benefits, she said no, because how could they get any better? You can see pretty much any doctor you want and pay practically nothing out of pocket. Randolph understands people not lucky enough to enjoy such gold-plated benefits might be envious.
I don't blame him for being jealous. This is a nice job.
There are only about 20,000 dock workers, such as Randolph, still working on the West Coast. Billions were lost as they negotiated for a better contract, and experts say it will take several months to clear the backlog at the ports. In Los Angeles, I'm Ben Bergman for Marketplace.
We had Quincy Jones on the program a couple of months ago. He of the 27 Grammy Awards, Quincy Jones, for an interview about a documentary film he was involved with about the guy who taught him to play the jazz trumpet when Jones was 13 years old. Clark Terry was that guy's name. He integrated the Tonight Show band back in 1960. He taught, besides Quincy Jones, Miles Davis and Wynton Marsalis, to name just a couple. He was an advocate of jazz education. And he was 94 when he died this past weekend, Clark Terry was. So we thought we'd play a quick clip of Quincy Jones from our show just a couple of months ago.
Clark is, to me, one of the greatest trumpet players that ever lived. Huh. No question about it. With joy, humor, even in his mumbles, his version of scatting, you know.
Yeah. You better give me yourself. We've got that whole interview on our website. It's pretty good. Check it out, marketplace.org. How do you not love that, right? Okay, coming up.
They both held on to the technologies that made them great, and they held on too long.
What happens when two innovative companies stop innovating? Yeah, nothing good, I'll tell you that. But first, let's do the numbers. Not so much doing on Wall Street today. The Dow Industrials gave back 23 points, about a 10%. Ended things at 18,116. The NASDAQ gained 5 points, 10%, 4960 there. The S&P 500 lost just a fraction of a point, we'll call it. What's that word we always use? Oh, yeah, flat, 2109. By way of corporate news, shares in Valeant Pharmaceuticals climbed nearly 15% today. On word over the weekend, the Canadian drug maker would buy Salix Pharmaceuticals, which makes drugs for stomach bugs. Shares in Salix slipped 1.3% today. Health insurers got a shot in the arm when the federal government proposed a cut in Medicare Advantage. That maybe seems backward until you learn that the cut announced now seems to indicate there will not be a larger-than-expected cut later in capitalism. Great. Humana shares up 5%, United Health Group up 3 1/3, and you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Epson, with workforce all-in-one printers powered by Precision Core technology. Built for office and workgroup printing, they're designed to help businesses run at full speed. Where there's business, there's Epson. And by T. Rowe Price. The markets may be uncertain, but institutions, advisors, and individuals choose T. Rowe Price's disciplined investment approach to help reach their long-term investment goals. T. Rowe Price. Invest with confidence. And by RingCentral, the cloud communications system that integrates with CRM, sales, and support applications like Salesforce, Zendesk, Box, and now Google for Work. Drive business forward. RingCentral.com.
Thank you.
get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. The Conference Board releases its monthly Consumer Confidence Index. A Senate committee looks at the United States' goals in human space exploration. And it's World Spay Day, highlighting the need to care for pets and community strays. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Hundreds of thousands of kids pass through the juvenile justice system in this country every year. Tens of thousands of them wind up going away to what's referred to in the language of juvenile justice as secure detention facilities. We're going to spend some time with those kids today and tomorrow on the topic of education, because there is often not a whole lot of it. There are too few teachers, not enough resources, and a mindset oftentimes of punishment first, rehabilitation later, which means when kids in juvie finally do get out, they're often further behind academically than they were when they went in, and so they wind up right back in the system. Late last year, the Department of Education and the Department of Justice issued some new rules urging states to make education the first priority for juveniles, specifically by using classroom technology that's common in public schools. Marketplace's Adrian Hill from Learning Curve, which is our project on education and technology, went to one of the first justice facilities in the country that has embraced the digital classroom. It's the Wyoming Girls School in Sheridan, Wyoming.
The first thing you notice as you drive up to the Wyoming Girls School is how little it looks like a secure juvenile detention facility. There are no gates, no barbed wire. White-tailed deer roam the grounds. The only fences here are meant to keep the horses from escaping. The 39 girls who've been sentenced to live here have committed mostly nonviolent crimes. They are 14 to 18. They're high schoolers. They take high school classes.
I'm looking for New York, New York. While we're looking for this, we have to get the longitude and latitude. And
in geography, the girls are using Google Earth. In horticulture, they're going to rig up iPads to monitor temperature and humidity in the greenhouse. The classes here are a lot like classes you might find in a good public school. Attentive teachers, focused lessons, modern technology.
If that condition is true.
That makes sense?
No.
Okay, so what it's going to say is you're going to say if Carol is facing east, do this.
That's teacher Jordan O'Donnell. He walks a class of three young women through a coding lesson.
I guess trying to kind of empower these students here to think beyond the, you know, what got them here, to get them involved in coding and, you know, STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. And it's the response from them has been kind of what kept me going, too.
Many of these young women failed in their public schools. They skipped, they dropped out. But here, says 14-year-old Shawnee, that's not an option.
It's a lot easier to stay caught up and keeping your grades up, because you can't really skip school. You kind of have to come.
Shawnee has been at the Wyoming Girls School for about 4.5 months. And in that time, she's fallen in love, as only a 14-year-old can, with coding. It gives her a sense of control.
When people meditate, they do that to come at peace with themselves and overcome stress and stuff like that. And that's kind of what coding is for me. It's my meditation.
She's already taken the computer science class, so she's doing an online coding class in her free time.
If I hadn't been here and I hadn't discovered coding, then I would be running around like a chicken with their head cut off, trying to figure out what I'm going to do with my future.
The Wyoming Girls School has a $6 million budget from the state. It doesn't include a line item for new teaching tech. So to create these digital classrooms, the teachers and administrators had to get creative. They snagged some hand-me-down Wi-Fi equipment from the local school. They use free tech like Google for Education and Edmodo. Jordan, the computer teacher and really one of the main forces behind the push for more tech here, raises money using a site called Donors Choose, basically Kickstarter for teachers. Kat Crawford is with the nonprofit Center for Educational Excellence in Alternative Settings. It helps secure facilities like the Wyoming Girls' School bring tech into the classrooms.
I can't imagine a student, especially in a high school setting, coming out or in a college setting, not having touched a piece of technology for a year and a half, finding success in school at all without having those skills taught to them.
But Crawford says the girls' school, it's still an outlier. Most juvenile justice facilities around the country where kids are locked up are way, way behind.
One of the biggest hurdles is just getting the internet turned on.
There's a fear that it's dangerous to let kids online, even with monitoring software. So in many facilities, says Kat, kids are handed a stack of worksheets, some secondhand textbooks, and may get little or no instruction, which might help explain why so many kids in the juvenile justice system leave in worse shape academically than when they came in, and why so many kids don't go back to high school or do go back and drop out. It's something the federal government has made clear has to change and can.
They have an ability to amass a huge number of credits while they're inside a correctional facility, and they can do so much while they're there.
At the Wyoming Girls' School, every student eligible to graduate from high school in 2013 did graduate. On average, they made a year's worth of progress in math during their nine-month stays, and nearly 3 years of progress in reading. It can all sound pretty good, but 17-year-old Jesse reminds me no teenager wants to live like this.
I don't think anyone's really happy to be here.
For the last 6 months, she's lived every minute of every day by strict rules and with constant supervision as she works through the program.
It's very stressful. It's you kind of feel like a science experiment. You're getting like pretty much poked and prod, like, hey, you're doing this. Hey, you're doing this. You need to, you know. So it's really overwhelming because you have so many people telling you what you need to change.
But when I ask her how school here compares with school on the outside?
I can't really say because I never really went. No one noticed when I was gone. I would like ask to go to the bathroom and come back a half an hour later high, and no one noticed the difference.
Here she says her teachers do know what's going on and they care.
It's really comforting because you're like, oh, other people notice me and I'm actually getting attention that I've been deprived of for so many years.
That kind of personal connection, says Wyoming Girls' School Superintendent Chris Jones, can encourage girls to develop the confidence and skills they need to succeed on the outside. I asked Jones what she says to people who question if we ought to be spending this much money and these resources on girls who've gotten into trouble.
And my answer is absolutely. A, they're kids, and it's the right thing to do. I guess I keep coming back to that.
And B, she says?
To affect change on the front end rather than waiting until the far end. Yeah, it is a little costly, I think, financially and resource-wise. But it long-term, if it keeps kids out of prison, if it keeps kids out of the system or reoffending and all of the ripple effects financially, it's actually pretty cheap.
Long-term, giving incarcerated kids a quality education on the inside improves the chances that they'll succeed on the outside. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
We put together a slideshow of some of that technology at work inside the Wyoming Girls' School. You can also hear more from students and administrators there at marketplace.org. And then coming up tomorrow, Adrienne has a story on the challenges of bringing the digital classroom to a big urban lockdown facility down in San Diego, California. If you put on a pair of sunglasses today, or if you have an LCD television at home, or if you use any one of a zillion other consumer products that use polarization, you've got Edwin Land to thank. Land mastered the technology that helps reduce glare and that also helped get him to what would become his company's most famous invention, the Polaroid SX70 instant camera. But as often happens in corporate America, the lawyers got involved. A landmark patent infringement lawsuit against Kodak is the foundation of a book about Edwin Land. It's called A Triumph of Genius. Author Ron Feirstein helped represent Edwin Land in that lawsuit. Mr. Feirstein, good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
You call Edwin Land, the subject of this book, the original Steve Jobs, which is quite a statement. What do you mean?
Well, there are tremendous parallels. They were both college dropouts. They both single-handedly developed tremendous technology companies that were the envy of their generations. They introduced products that the public didn't even know they wanted, and that was really Land's first philosophy, but Jobs adapted it. Jobs idolized Land. He respected him and thought that he was the kind of person that America should look up to.
The root of this book, right, and the root of Edwin Land's story, really, in terms of how we know it today, is the lawsuit against Kodak for patent infringement. But Kodak was Polaroid's first big customer for this polarizer thing that he invented, right?
They were. And the relationship between Kodak and Land and Polaroid, Land's company, over the next six decades really almost had an operatic arc to it. They went from protege-mentor to a period in the 60s, 50s, 60s, where Polaroid was Kodak's second largest corporate customer. They manufactured every negative in Polaroid film from the 40s all the way into the 60s. But when Land's last great technology, the instant photograph known as SX-70 that developed it in your hand, came out, Kodak saw that as the first potential threat to their dominance of consumer photography.
Polaroid, we should say, wins this patent lawsuit. The Kodak is found to have infringed.
Correct. Kodak had to pay almost $1 billion in damages, $925 million to be exact, which until a few weeks ago held the record for the most damages ever. And more importantly, Kodak had to take their cameras and film out of the stores. Even though 13 million Americans had Kodak cameras, they could no longer buy film, and those cameras immediately became obsolete.
You know, it's funny because these two companies, Kodak and Polaroid, were giants of American photography. And now, I mean, Polaroid's gone through bankruptcy a couple of times. It's enjoying something of a resurgence. But Kodak is a shell of its former self. What happened?
I think they both held on to the technologies that made them great, and they held on too long. And it's partly understandable. I mean, in Polaroid's case, instant photography was the only technology it was involved in, and it became obsolete. Kodak was a little more complicated because Kodak was more of a vertical company in the sense that they had companies that created the cameras and the film, but the components of the film. They made the chemicals, they made the paper, they made the plastic. They had the entire conventional photography field covered, and they held on to it, and they held on to it. And the irony is that some of the earliest work in digital photography was done in the Kodak labs. But because they were so invested in what technologists call silver halide technology, which is just a way of referencing conventional film as we know it, they had no interest in pursuing it, and they went down with the ship.
Ron Feierstein's book about Edwin Land and the patent war that Polaroid had with Kodak is called A Triumph of Genius. Ron, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Edwin Land, as it happens, also served six presidents in complete secrecy from World War II through the Cold War. We've got more details about that and an excerpt of the book as well. It's at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, which comes with the observation that, well, that the tooth fairy that comes to my house may in fact be a cheapskate. I've got a 7-year-old who's about to lose a tooth. It's just a couple of good wiggles and a twist or two away from coming out. And when it does, I feel pretty safe in guessing that she's going to get about a buck under her pillow. Turns out, though, tooth fairies that go to other houses are a bit more fast and loose with their cash. A survey by the insurance company Delta Dental says the national average for American kids when they lose teeth is $4.36. And if there is a 7-year-old girl listening to this radio program, not in my house, I'll tell you that.
Marketplace is supported by CIT, providing commercial lending, leasing, and advisory services to small and middle market businesses for over 100 years. More at CIT.com. And by Kronos, helping businesses increase revenue, lower costs, and improve customer satisfaction with cloud-based workforce management solutions. More at Kronos.com. Kronos, workforce innovation that works. And by Epson, with workforce all-in-one printers for business powered by Precision Core Technology. Workforce printers designed for home and offices and work groups. Epson.com.
Seriously, $4.36? Come on. All right, the Dow gave back 23 points today, a 10%. The NASDAQ up 5 points, a 10%. The S&P 500 down just a fraction of a point. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Tommy Andres, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APN.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Jerez, host of This is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.